Bible. So that would be the connection between the Bishop's Bible and the King James. And if we have time, I also want to talk about the Elizabethan context of the Bishop's Bible. So if we're going to understand the Bishop's Bible, we've got to understand what was going on in England at the time that Elizabeth took over. Before we do that, though, and I just have to be honest, some things have taken a few turns for me even since yesterday when I sent you the notes. It's on this first point of the connection between the King James and the Bishop's Bible. And this is a very important point that I think we need to make sure that we nail and try to prove very clearly what's going on with this point. So if we don't get to the second half of this today, I'm not going to be too worried about it. We'll just move those notes off till next Sunday because I want to make sure that we understand some things. So I do have a huge pile of books today. There's a reason why I have all these, and hopefully as we go through things this morning, it'll be clear to you why I brought all this stuff, and there's some things that I want to show you, and not only obviously you guys here, but also folks who are either joining us now live or after the fact who might be watching this, the recording or listening. So let's look at the introduction. So lesson 137, the Bishop's Bible, connection with the King James Bible and the Elizabethan context. Introduction. The last nine lessons have focused on the popular and influential 1560 Geneva Bible. Having formally concluded that study last week in lesson 136, we will now turn our attention to the next Bible of prominence, the Bishop's Bible. First appearing in 1568, the Bishop's Bible is perhaps the most overlooked and misunderstood of the pre-King James English Bibles. So I say two things there. I think it is overlooked, and I think it's misunderstood. I think both of those statements are true. So we've been spending a lot of time talking about the 1560 Geneva Bible. The Bishop's Bible is going to come out in 1568, and there's a lot to say about all that as we get rolling here, okay? So there are many reasons for this. There are many reasons for why I think the Bishop's Bible is overlooked and misunderstood. And we're going to try to unravel those reasons for that here in the coming weeks. How many saw my Facebook post this week where I had the photograph of a page from the 1602 Bishop's Bible with the handwritten notations of the King James translators in the margin? Some of you may have saw that Facebook post that I made. I made it Friday, and it was kind of like a little bit of a plug or an advertisement for this lesson that we're going to be doing right now. So this morning we're going to begin our investigation considering the following two points. The first thing we want to look at is misconceptions regarding the connection between the Bishop's and King James Bibles. And then if we have time, we'll look at the religious context of Elizabethan England. So if we have time, we'll get to that. If not, I'm not going to really be worried about it so much. Okay? Because I do have some extra things here that I want to cover that aren't necessarily in the notes here. So as I was saying a moment ago, after I sent the notes to Sylvia yesterday, so the procedure that we normally follow is I type the notes. Friday or Saturday, I send them to Sylvia. Mike and Sylvia will give them a first, read through and review and make any obvious corrections or to errors or mistakes that I've typed into the notes. Then the notes are printed and then you guys have them in front of you now. And then obviously almost every week we go through them and find more stuff that needs to be fixed, right? And then we note those things and then fix them for later on. But even yesterday afternoon after I sent Sylvia the notes, I was looking at some things and I might make some deviations from what we have here, or at least elaborate on this first point. So let's talk about misconceptions regarding the connection between the Bishop's and King James Bibles. The impact of the Bishop's Bible upon the King James Bible has been largely misunderstood by King James advocates. So many of the folks historically that have advocated for the King James or would be what you would call or might use the word King James only to describe, there are many, the Bishop's Bible and the connection between the Bishop's Bible and the King James has been, in my opinion, largely misunderstood by these folks, right? Many King James only proponents maintain that the translators simply did not follow the rules set forth by King James and Bishop Richard Bancroft, the chief overseer of the project. 15 rules were given for the guidance of the translators as they conducted their work. Now, when we get to the King James, we will cover all 15 of these rules. Right now, we're just looking at the connection between the Bishop's Bible and the King James Bible. Now, the reason I'm talking, if this is the first lesson we're doing on the Bishop's Bible, this connection between the Bishop's Bible and the King James Bible is extremely important to nail down here right at the beginning of this conversation, because it has been largely misunderstood by people who are King James only advocates or defenders of the King James, right? And so they say, as I say in this point here, many King James only proponents maintain that the translators simply did not follow the rules set forth by King James and Bishop Richard Bancroft, the chief overseer of the project. 15 rules were given for the guidance of the translators as they conducted their work. So, rule number one, given to the King James translators by Bishop Richard Bancroft, was to follow the Bishop's Bible unless the truth of the original determined otherwise. Okay? So I'm going to try to make this a little bit bigger for hopefully the benefit of folks. But that's this point right here. This is rule number one, and that's the original language, right? It says, the ordinary Bible to be read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. Okay, so let's make sure we understand what that's saying. That's saying, what were they supposed to use as the base text? The Bishop's Bible, right? The ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. So as long as the translators perceived that there was nothing wrong with the Bishop's Bible, were they supposed to follow the Bishop's Bible? If they felt the original, meaning the Hebrew or the Greek, if they felt the original was better expressed some other way, then were they free to deviate from the Bishop's Bible? But unless the truth of the original would say otherwise, rule number one told them that they should follow what? The Bishop's Bible. Okay? Everybody see that as a baseline for this conversation, right? Look at the next point. Rule 14 identified which translations should be consulted when it was determined that the Bishop's Bible was incorrect in a given reading. Okay? So if the Bishop's Bible was determined by the translators to not be the correct sense or the correct reading given the Hebrew or the Greek, Rule 14 steps in and then says what else they should look at. All right, let's look at that rule. It says, so this would be Rule 14, these translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the Bishop's Bible. Tyndale's, that's the old spelling of Tyndal, okay? Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's, which is the Great Bible, and the Geneva. Okay, so rule number one says what are they supposed to follow? The bishops, right? Unless the truth of the original, so they're supposed to follow it, and as little alter the bishops as the truth of the original will permit. That's what rule number one says, right? Rule 14 says that these translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the Bishop's Bible, then they're supposed to consult Tyndale, the Matthew's Bible, Coverdale, Whitchurch's of the Great Bible, and the Geneva Bible, right? So that would be all six of the predecessors to the King James, right? So the bishops, rule number one, that'd be number one. Tyndale would be number two. Matthew's would be number three. Coverdale would be number four. The Great Bible would be number five. And the Geneva Bible would be number six, right? So you have all six of the previous English translations are in play according to the rules that are given to the translators that are set forth by King James and Richard Bancroft. And they are to follow the text of the bishops and alter it as little as the truth of the original will what? Will allow or will permit. Okay? So, before we go any further, does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the king and the bishop, Archbishop Bancroft, intended for these rules to be followed?
Yes.
I would say yes. Okay? Are they doing this at the king's behest under divine authority? Divine authority. I'm at royal authority. Okay? So these are the rules that the king and his Archbishop Richard Bancroft devised and set forth for them to follow. Right? So we get the last point on page one. Many defenders of the King James have argued, based upon Rule 14, so this rule right here that identifies Tyndale, Matthews, Coverdale, Whitchurch, and Geneva, many defenders of the King James have argued, based upon Rule 14, that the translators ignored Rule 1, so that they ignored this one about the bishops, that they ignored Rule 1, because they viewed the bishops as inferior to its predecessors, particularly Tyndale and Geneva. Okay, so this is a common assertion that is made by defenders of the King James, that rule number one is ignored in favor of rule what?
14.
Okay? Now, we'll say why. I'm seeing some furrowed brows, like there might be some questions, okay? Let's just go a little further, and then we'll see what questions you might have about this, okay? So, an example of this thinking can be found in the transcribed notes of the manuscript evidence class in Grace School of the Bible. Okay? In these notes, Pastor Richard Jordan stated the following regarding the process adopted by the King James translators. Here's what he says, quoting from the transcribed notes. So he gives rule number one. The ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, is to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit. So that's rule number one. Now, that rule was largely ignored in practice. So what's he saying about rule number one? They ignored it in practice. Okay? The reason is number 14. Rule number one is modified by rule number 14. Okay, so understand what the claim there is. The claim there is that rule 14 modifies rule number one, and they just decided to, we can ignore rule number one and we'll just follow rule what? 14. Does everybody see what's being said there? Okay? This is Richard Jordan saying this in Grace School of the Bible. Alright? So, let me read that again. Now that rule was largely ignored in practice. The reason is number 14. Rule 1 is modified by rule number 14, and then he quotes rule 14, which we've already looked at. These translations to be used when they agree better with the text of the bishops include... These translations to be used when they agree better with the text than the bishop's Bible. I think there's a typo there in the notes because I copied and pasted this. With the bishop's Bible, Tyndale, Matthews, Coverdale, Whitchurch, Geneva. All right? So, let's just stop and make sure we understand what's being said there. Again, what's being said there is, rule number one says this about the bishop's Bible, but rule 14 modifies rule number one. And so in practice, they just ignored rule number one. One. They just ignored it in practice. Okay? Let's read on. Now we've studied the Tyndale, the Matthews, the Coverdale, the Whitchurch, and the Geneva Bible last time. So in Grace School of the Bible, there was one lesson devoted to all of those Bibles that we've spent weeks on. Okay, now again, I'm not saying that as a statement to criticize what was in Grace School of the Bible. I'm just stating that, I'm just showing you that from the beginning we've tried to be way more thorough than that in our presentation of things because we want to make sure that we have an accurate understanding. Okay? So he says, now we've studied the Tyndale, the Matthews, the Coverdale, the Whitchurch, and the Geneva Bible last time. We saw Tyndale's influence all three. Because of that, number one wasn't followed too much. Okay, so what is he saying? He's saying the translators didn't follow what? Rule one, too much at least, okay? The influence of those Bibles, write this down and remember it. Number one, the most influential of the translations was Tyndale. And then there's a parenthesis there about the spelling of Tyndale, okay? The second most influential of the translations was Coverdale. The third most influential was the Geneva. The fourth was the Bishops. The Matthews, Tyndale, and Coverdale wasn't used so much. And that's from pages 89 to 90 in the transcribed notes of manuscript evidence from Grace School of Bible. Okay? Now, what is he saying there? He's saying that they didn't follow rule number one, that they followed rule number 14 instead, and therefore the Bishop's Bible wasn't used very much, and that of the six Bibles that are listed, including the Bishop's, for the translators to use, they used Tyndale the most, they used Coverdale the second most, third most Geneva, fourth most was the Bishop's. And then he says that Matthew's, Tyndale and Coverdale wasn't used so much. Okay? Now let me just say, there's nothing else said to substantiate that claim. It's just kind of said, and then nothing further is stated regarding it. Okay? So, let's just stop there. Are there any questions? Yes?
The rules seem quite practical and common sense. If you have a translation and then you have a thought that this may not be accurate, that you compare the other ones to in 14. But on the other hand, is there any evidence that there was prejudice or bias? How many translators were there involved? And
there is tons of evidence.
And then the other thing is, did they ever go back to the originals or the Greek?
Of course, yes, all the time.
So were those influences? Because it sounds like it's specific little errors that they're correcting, and it may be the translation.
So you got to remember, Bart, I'm only giving you right here 14 rules.
Yeah.
And the only point that I'm trying to make right now is whether or not there's a, to what degree is the connection between the Bishops and the King James.
Yeah.
That's the only thing we're talking about. When we get into the King James itself, I have tons of stuff we'll talk about as far as what they looked at when they did the process. Okay? Right now, all I care about is the connection between these two English Bibles and the assertions that are made. Okay?
I've always heard that the King James was kind of a compilation and an easier read or easier reading with understanding for the people of the day, but that's not necessarily...
Well, the King James definitely is a compilation of earlier versions,
yeah.
Earlier English versions. The question is, to what degree is it reliant on the bishops according to rule number one? So, Brother Jordan is saying what? There's a strong correlation or not a very strong correlation? Not a very strong correlation between the bishops and the King James. In fact, he says that that Tyndale, Coverdale, and Geneva were more influential in the process than the bishops because Rule 14 modified Rule Number 1. All right. So what I'm after here is not when we get to discussing the King James Bible and its process, we'll talk about everything they looked at and everything they used, right? Right now we're just trying to figure out what is the connection between the bishops and the King James, okay? Because these are the rules that the king and the archbishop gave to the translators, right? So, does everybody understand what he's saying here? All right, so let's read the next point. Teaching in the early 1980s, Brother Jordan asserted that Rule 1 was, quote, largely ignored in practice by the King James translators. And I'm going to say to you that I believe that is not a true statement. I don't think that's an accurate statement. I don't think so. Now, he's teaching this in like 1983. Okay? So you have to think then, and this is where you have to put your thinking cap on and do some historical analysis and start thinking about, well, why would he say that? What was out there sort of in the thought stream, and why would he say that they essentially ignored rule number one in favor of rule 14, which modifies this, which then gave them the sort of license, if you will, to follow the other ones and not the bishops, right? Well, first of all, I think there's some confusion along these lines, right? We know, and this is why we spent so much time talking about it. Tyndale, and I can't spell. We know that Tyndale, that the Matthew's Bible followed which Bible? Tyndale, right? And the Matthew's Bible, we know, is two-thirds who? Tyndale. Remember studying that? Okay. Then the Great Bible from 1539 is a revision of the Matthew's Bible, which was how much Tyndale?
Two-thirds.
You with me so far? When we get to it, the Bishop's Bible from 1568, the Bishop's Bible is going to be a revision of which? The Great Bible. So the Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible is a revision of Matthew's. Matthew's is two-thirds what?
Tyndale,
which means the Great Bible is two-thirds who?
Tyndale,
which means the Bishop's Bible, which is a revision of the Great Bible, is two-thirds who?
Tyndale.
So then if the King James is a revision of the bishops, then this one is also going to be two-thirds who?
Tyndale.
Now, why is Matthew's two-thirds Tyndale, but all the other translations are assumed to be two-thirds Tyndale?
Because Matthew's, you weren't here when we talked about this part, Matthew's Bible is the entirety of the New Testament is William Tyndale's New Testament, and the portions of the Old Testament from Genesis through 2 Chronicles and Jonah in the Matthew's Bible are all from Tyndale's work that he did before he died.
And assumed to be correct.
Well, then the Great Bible moves all of that work from Tyndale that was found in the Matthew's Bible. It moves it forward
without
much revision to the work of Tyndale. So to the extent that the King James is two-thirds Tyndale, it's because of this whole what? This whole thing. It's not because they sat down and were like, we just like Tyndale better than the Bishop's Bible. It's because the Bishop's Bible literally is two-thirds who?
Tyndale,
because of this whole thing that we've been studying, right? Which is why we spent so much time on it. So that you can understand when we get to this point why things are the way they are. You following that? Any questions about that? So in 1983-84, when Brother Jordan is teaching the school, you have to say, okay, well, what's available to him? Why would a statement be made that they basically ignored the Bishop's Bible? And why would a statement like that be made? So I started thinking about that. And I wasn't satisfied with what I had done, so I started poking around, right? So the first thing I want to read to you, and this is not in the notes, so I might have to add this later on. So I have here Gerald Hammond's book from 1982, The Making of the English Bible. 1982, right? So right around the same time that the manuscript evidence class was being taught, I want to read to you from page 144, okay? So this is Gerald Hammond, The Making of the English Bible, page 144. He says, quote, "The authorized version translator's problem was quite straightforward. Their brief was not to make a new translation, but as far as possible to base their work on an existing English text. And this, for James, the piper calling the tune, was the Bishop's Bible. Hence came the first rule laid down in the list of those to be observed in the translation of the Bible. Rule 1, the ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit." So that's the third time we've seen the rule, right? Then he says, "But the pressure for a new translation had been an essentially Puritan one led at the conference by John Reynolds in the belief that the existing versions were corrupt and not answerable to the truth of the original. Both in answer to this call and for their own scholarly abilities, the Authorized Version translators knew that the Bishop's Bible was the most corrupt and the Geneva Bible the least, and if they were to use a copy text, making a good one better, then this good one would have to be the Geneva Bible. So what is he asserting here? He's asserting that they didn't follow rule number one, but they followed what as their base text? The Geneva Bible. That's what Hammond is saying. I just read it to you, right? Further down the list of notes at rule number 14, there was an order whose strict interpretation would inevitably result in a Bible closer to the Geneva than any other. Rule 14. These translations to be used when they agree better with the text of the Bishop's Bible, Tyndale's, Matthew's, Coverdale's, Whitchurch's, Geneva. In essence, this rule, not the first, was the one the translators followed, and the Geneva Bible, not the Bishop's Bible, became the foundation of the Authorized Version. Okay? So does that sound a lot like what Brother Jordan said in the school notes? Almost exactly. Now, I can't prove, I've written to him, I'm just going to be above board here, I've written him and asked him where he got that from, where he got that statement from. I suspect it may have been from Hammond. This book was written in 1982. It would have been available to him, and it's very similar to what it says in the notes, okay? Not satisfied with that, I went a little bit further, and I looked at Peter Ruckman's The History of the New Testament Church. Because I know that Brother Jordan went to Pensacola for a time, and he went there for the manuscript evidence and for the church history information. So I started poking around in here, and I found a couple things. So this book was printed in 1982, and I'm reading now from page 482. The Geneva Bible was another revision of Tyndale made by Whittingham. It omitted the Apocrypha altogether. That's false. That is absolutely a false statement by Peter Ruckman. It did not altogether omit the Apocrypha. That's a flat-out falsehood, not true statement. It used late manuscripts to correct Vaticanus, the main manuscript for the ASV, New American Standard, NIV, and used instead the old French translations from the Albigensians and the old German translations from Bohemia. Tyndale then was the main force behind the English translations, and although Catholic rumors have always had it that the AV was based on the Bishop's Bible, it certainly was not. The AV of 1611 is 90% the English of Tyndale. If the AV committee didn't follow their orders to go by the Bishop's Bible, no apostate fundamentalist should be too upset. After all, Westcott and Hort, after professing to be engaged in making a few changes to the AV text as possible, and then lying about only one word, a thousand makes any difference, etc. Okay? So what does Ruckman say flat out in this book? That they did not follow what? They did not follow rule number one, and that it is a Catholic rumor. I'll read it again. Lost my spot. The main force behind the English translation, although Catholic rumors have always had it that the AV was based on the Bishop's Bible, it certainly was not. That's page 482 from The History of the New Testament Church, Volume 1. Saying, Authorized Version, King James. Okay? So there's two examples from 1982. One flat out saying that it was not based upon the Bishop's Bible. The other one saying it was based upon the Geneva Bible. You with me so far? So let's look at History of the Christian Church, Volume 2. Reading from the preface. Page X and page XI. Since the King James Bible was also a revision of Tyndale, as was the Geneva Bible. No, that's where that was. I think I read that. That's the part I wanted. So is he, he's saying, since the King James Bible is also a revision of Tyndale, as was the Geneva Bible, America got off to a flying start. She became the first nation to be organized and established with a Bible translated by anti-Catholic Christians whom Catholics had burned at the stake. Okay? Here's the comment about the bishops. And whether they knew it or not, the book that they took to be the Holy Bible was written under the wise regulation that if the Tyndale version and the Geneva version stood against the bishop's Bible, the bishop's Bible was to be rejected in favor of Tyndale. So where would the idea be coming from that Tyndale was preeminent, that the bishop's Bible was a Catholic Bible and ignored? To me, it would be coming from who? It would be coming from Ruckman. Okay, so let's go to the back and read from Endnote on this chapter. Endnote to the preface, number 3. He says, so this is all stuff that's not in the notes because I looked into all this stuff yesterday afternoon. And I about chucked these books on a heap and burned them, frankly. I'm so irritated with them. But folks, you've got to understand, are King James advocates today reading Ruckman with blinders on, thinking this guy's telling them the truth? He's not. If you are relying on Ruckman, I'm saying it very clearly, if you're relying on Ruckman for all of your information, you are making a mistake. Because he is not giving you honest information. Okay, so I'll get all the hate mail now, okay? Number 3, talking about the same point, this is interesting as the common legend passed down from one university campfire to another is that because the translators were ordered to follow the bishop's Bible, they did. The truth is that they did not. Similarities between Tyndale and the bishop's Bible are due to the bishop's Bible following Tyndale. Fraud, this is a guy's name, wrote a book, says the AV bears the impress of one man, and that man is William Tyndale. So where did the idea come from that the bishop's Bible was ignored by the King James translators? There's at least 2 examples there from potentially Hammond, for sure from who? From Ruckman. In the early 80s, Ruckman was standard reading and authoritative for anybody who was a King James only advocate. Okay? You with me? So, let's go back to the notes. This teaching in the early 80s by Brother Jordan asserted that rule number 1 was largely ignored, was, quote, largely ignored in practice by the King James translators. This is not a true statement. Okay? Now, I also want to bring to your attention something else. So this is from the very first lesson. So I have this on the screen here. This is from the very first lesson, lesson number 1. We're now on lesson 137. I said, new discoveries made in the 1960s and 70s at libraries in Great Britain. Notable discoveries include Manuscript 98, The Notes of John Boyce, and Bod 1602, a bound copy of a 1602 edition of the Bishop's Bible with handwritten notes by the translators in the margin. These discoveries were studied throughout the 1970s with books explaining their significance first appearing in the late 70s and the mid 90s. So that would be this book right here, The Coming of the King James Epistles, a collation of the work in progress. This is by Ward Allen and Edward Jacobs. This book was published, and I believe the date there is what? The date on this one is 1995. Okay? Then the other one there is the translating of the New Testament epistles from 1997. And that's this book right here. The translation of the New Testament epistles, 1604, a manuscript of King James Westminster Company. These books were not known to exist by the main advocates of the King James position. And a third one would be the Notes of John Boyce. This one was published in 1969. Now, to be fair, I have located a statement in the printed transcribed notes of Grace School of Bible's manuscript evidence class that Brother Jordan had a copy of the notes of Boyce and he was aware of them in the early 80s, but this one was published in 1969. So this was the earliest of the three to be published. This one was published in 1969, this one was published in 1995, and this one here was published in 1997. Alright, and this one's about manuscript 98, this one is about Bod 1602, and this one is about the notes of John Boyce. So there are three primary documents that have survived, that have come down to us. So look at page 2, the bottom of the page. Recall that on Sunday, October 18, 2020, I taught a lesson titled A Brief History of the King James Only Movement, in which, among other things, I noted how the modern King James Only movement was forged without a working knowledge of the three key primary documents, Bod 1602, Manuscript 98, and the Notes of John Boyce. The comments above by Pastor Jordan confirmed the veracity of my statements from October. Okay? In other words, he was not aware, when he taught this class in the early 80s, he was not aware of the witness of Bod 1602 to the process or of Manuscript 98. He didn't know this information when he taught them. And I believe if he had known this information, there's no way he would have said this. Okay? Which tells you what about Ruckman and Hammond? Ruckman and Hammond had a big influence, but did they know this stuff? They didn't know this stuff either. Or they wouldn't have said what they said. Is everybody following me? A lot to track with here, okay? But this is important stuff to get down. Scholarly Works by Ward S. Allen. So again, that would be this one here, 1977, translating the New Testament epistles, and 1995, the coming of the King James Gospels. Scholarly Works by Ward S. Allen, David Norton. David Norton, A Textual History of the King James Bible, and The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today. And then also Lawrence Vance, The Making of the King James Bible, New Testament, 2015. Scholarly Works by Ward S. Allen, David Norton, and Lawrence M. Vance confirm that rule one, to follow the bishop's Bible, was taken very seriously by the King James translators. Okay, let's go to top page 3. In his 2011 publication commemorating the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, titled The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today, that's this book right here, by Norton, Professor David Norton states the following regarding how seriously rule number one was taken. Quote, Robert Barker, the King's printer, supplied 40 unbound copies of the 1602 Bishop's Bible for the translators to use, not only ensuring they worked from the right text by enabling them, if they wished, to work by annotating it. Annotating it means what? Putting notes on the pages. So they have unbound leaves of a 1602 Bishop's Bible. The King's printer, Robert Barker, printed 40 of these, didn't bind them, and distributed them to the different translating companies for them to work off of. Okay?
So they were companies. They weren't individual people.
They did. There were six companies. The Bible was divided up. They did their work in their companies, and then they conferred. So again, that's another thing we'll go over in more detail later on. The only description of how the companies worked comes from John Selden, who knew Andrews and Bedwell, and no doubt others of the translators, and so maybe repeating what he knew from them of the First Westminster Company's practice. He said that, quote, that part of the Bible was given to him who was most excellent in such a tongue, as the Apocrypha to Downs. And then they met together, and one read the translation. So that would be the bishop's Bible. The rest holding in their hands some Bible, either of the learned tongues, so that would be Hebrew or Latin or Greek, or French, Spanish, Italian, etc. If they found any fault, they spoke. If not, he read on. So they're literally reading from a bishop's Bible. The other dudes in the room have, one guy has an Italian, another guy has a French, the next guy has a German, another guy has a Greek, a Hebrew, a Chaldean, you know, they got all this stuff and they're reading out loud and they're, oh, well, and then they would go through it, and if somebody objected to something, they would, oh, wait a minute, I don't think that's right, and then they would discuss it. That's just a mindset, an understanding of the process they're using, okay? The translation referred to was the bishop's Bible, and the practice of commenting on it as occasion arose seems sensible. Presumably the comments were made in light of each individual translator's preparation for the meeting and their particular version, or I don't know what that should say. Well, I'll have to check that. He had been designed to keep an eye, I think I should say, yeah, he had been designed to keep an eye on. Two pieces of work survived from the companies. Annotations to parts of the bishop's Bible Gospels and a partial manuscript of the epistles. The annotated Gospels may well represent the earliest surviving stage of the work. The translators worked on unbound sheets of a 1602 Bible. As is shown by the way, many of their annotations disappear into the binding. So obviously when they wrote on them, they were unbound, and then later they were what? Bound together, and some of their writing notes disappear into the binding after they were bound. Okay? Let's read on. Sheets from at least two parts of the work, plus annotated sheets needed to make a complete Bible, were gathered together and bound sometime after the work on the King James Bible was completed as a complete 1602 Bishop's Bible, Bodleian Library Bible, English, 1602B, here abbreviated as Bod 1602. So if you wanted to go see this Bible, that's the call, that's the call words to pull it off the stacks. Bodleian Library Bible, English, 1602B. So if you went to the Bodleian Library and asked for that, the clerk would go find it for you, if they'll even let you touch it, and they might not, it might be in a case. But that's how you would access the Bible in the Bodleian Library, the 1602 Bishop's Bible. Yeah.
When they found those copies, I can understand that. But when they, you know, printed the new Bibles, were those notes typewritten in the side columns then, or how were they? Because they didn't have photocopy machines, so how did they?
Those were just for the revision. They weren't.
Oh, they weren't for the Bible.
So there's, look at this picture. So this is the next page in your notes. So here's the 1602 Bishop's Bible. You can see them crossing out words and then putting a, what do you want to call this? A footnote here about what they thought, how they thought it should read. So here's the 1602 Bishop's text, and here's the handwritten notes of the margin on a 1602 Bishop's text. So the idea that they just ignored rule number one is absolutely false. I mean, it's totally false. That's not what they did. There's manuscript documents in these British libraries showing you them working off of a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Yeah.
They know whose notes those were. I mean, those are the individual's notes.
These, so, great question. All of that is covered in this book by Ward and Jacobs. They don't know for sure the names of the people who made all the notes, but they do know that there are at least two or three different hands in this document who are making annotations to the text. And that what you can do is you can take a 1602 Bishop's Bible, you can look at these notes, and you can compare it to a King James Bible from 1611 and know without a doubt that what was going on in this process was the editorial work on what would eventually be the 1611 King James Bible.
Now, were these just one of the six groups that...
So one group did the Gospels.
Oh.
So this is a page from Luke...
those six groups were dividing the Bible?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so they weren't competing.
They weren't competing, they're working on different sections. So this document here, Manuscript 98... This document here is from the Westminster Company that did the epistles, the New Testament epistles. That's a different company than what did the Gospels.
Okay. thought they were competing.
No, they're not like in competition with each other. They're working in conjunction with each other by splitting up the work. And then once each company was done with their section, then they came together and they looked at the whole thing, all the different sections. But there is no doubt. What are they doing? What are they using as their base text? Are they following rule number one? There's no doubt about it, right? So anything in Ruckman, anything in Hammond, anything in all these books that is saying that this was a Roman Catholic legend passed down by the campfires of universities, that they followed the bishop's Bible, is absolute garbage. Okay? It's garbage, it's King James only folklore, and it's not true. Okay? I don't know how to say it more emphatically than that, but I want to get through the end of this point. Bottom of page 3. The manuscript, Lambeth Palace, manuscript 98, comes from the Westminster New Testament Company. It looks like a fair copy made from annotations such as those in the Gospels to enable review and further revision. Formally presented in 2 columns, it uses only the left column to give a partial revision of the bishop's Bible epistles, partial in that this column gives 1,769 verses and leaves numbered spaces for the remaining 1,013. The natural inference is that the company made no changes to those 1,013 verses. It expected the manuscript to be used in relation to the bishop's Bible, where the missing text could be found. So then you have page 4. You've got 2 pictures there. You've got page 4. Then you got another picture on... Did I give you 2 pictures? You got 2 pictures on pages 4 and 5 of Bod 1602. Let's go to page 6 in the notes. The 2015 work of Lawrence M. Vance, presented in The Making of the King James Bible New Testament, concurs with the earlier work done by Ward and Norton. Vance reports, quote, "There are 2 ways we know that the 1602 Bishop's Bible was the basis of the authorized version. First is the internal evidence, the sheer number of verses in the authorized version that match verbatim the text of the 1602 Bishop's Bible. This will be seen in the collation of the New Testament of the 1602 Bishop's Bible and the 1611 authorized version in the next section of this book. There are thousands of verses in a 1611 King James Bible that are a verbatim match to a 1602 Bishop's Bible." Okay? And second, the external evidence of a 1602 Bishop's Bible used by the King James translators, currently cataloged in the Bodleian Library as Bible English 1602 B1, the Bodleian Bishop's Bible, as it is called, is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with annotations of the King James translators that indicate the changes to be made to the Bishop's Bible. So again, that's these images right here. Okay? It is the only known survivor of the 40 large church Bibles that were supplied by Robert Barker to the King James translators. Together with a manuscript 98 in the Lambeth Palace Library that records the translators at work as they transformed the Bishop's Bible of 1602 into the authorized version of 1611. Folks, the amount of evidence is absolutely overwhelming. Okay? Let me read to you a couple things that aren't in the notes. So I'm reading from Lawrence Vance's 2015 book, The Making of the King James New Testament, from the analysis section at the top of page 247. He says, quote, "The collation." So what he did is he literally went verse by verse. He took Bod 1602, he took manuscript 98, he took a 1611 King James Bible, and he literally went through every single verse, comparing the 3 documents. Okay? "The collation of the New Testament of the authorized version of 1611 with the Bishop's Bible of 1602 yields the following results. Of the 7,957 verses in the New Testament, The authorized version reads exactly with the Bishop's Bible in 2,102 of them, 26.4% of the text. Is absolutely what?
Verbatim.
Thus it reads differently in 5,855 of them, 73.6%. Of the verses that differ, 2,225 of them, 38%, have only one simple change. One simple change. Maybe they spell the word different, maybe they picked a different word, but there's only one simple change. 1,602 of them, 27%, have two simple changes. So, think about it. 26% is verbatim. Another 38% is only a difference of one simple word. And another 27.4% is a difference of possibly two what?
Two words.
That's nearly almost, that's 80 some odd, I can't do the math in my head, I'm not good at it. That's over 80% is either exactly identical or two minor changes different.
When they talk about percent, that's referring to one sentence?
That's referring to the number, total number of changes.
In verses?
In any change that was made by the translators. So 2,000.
But I mean, if there were 10 verses and you changed one word, that would be 10%.
I don't know, it would be, so that's based upon the number of verses. So if they change one verse, that'd be one change.
Yeah.
If they changed two verses, that would be two changes. If they made two changes in one verse, that...
I'm just trying to figure out if the percentages seem high, but if it's considering a whole verse...
It's considering a whole verse.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yep. And then I'm going to skip to the end here. At the very end of this, he gives the totals. I mean, this guy wasn't messing around. Okay? And all the way in the end is the total of confluence between the Bishop's Bible and the AV. I know you can't read it because it's too small, but it says right there, 91%. So the King James and the Bishop's Bible, statistically, overall, are essentially 91% what? The same. Okay? Now, I know some of you are statisticians, and you're going to think more about that as well you should, but my point right now is to simply put to bed once and for all this idea that were they following rule number one? The evidence, the actual historical evidence is overwhelming. So that means, listen, that means that that these generations of King James onlyists that led the train out of the station, they said a bunch of stuff that wasn't true. They said a bunch of stuff that wasn't true, that was not factual.
What did they base their assumptions on? Was it a knee-jerk reaction?
They based their assumptions on the false assumption of the two streams, which they got from the Seventh-day Adventist Wilkinson. Remember, we talked about all that. Okay? So a lot of the argumentation of the movement from the very beginning was not right, was false. Now that doesn't cause me to question whether or not I have God's Word in my King James Bible, because I believe I do. But I believe there are better arguments and there's better evidence to prove these things out, which is what we're trying to do here and now. Okay, so let's finish this point. Page 6. The facts on the ground are simply contrary to the narrative embraced and espoused by many King James advocates. This is due in part to the fact that these documents were not widely known outside of Britain in the 1950s and 60s, when the King James only movement was leaving the train station in the United States. More recently, many King James only proponents have been reluctant to even consider the testimony provided by the surviving documents. This is my frustration right now with my contemporaries and my colleagues. Okay? They don't want to hear this stuff. Because if they're hearing, because listen, does this stuff that we're covering, does it throw a big wrench into certain things that have always been said? Yes. And my point and my contention is, wouldn't we be better off to revise our understanding in light of the facts than to continue to say stuff that's not true? Okay? Given the fact that the Bishop's Bible was the source text for the King James, it is critical that we accurately understand its history. It is to this endeavor that we will now turn our attention. In future lessons, we will consider the surviving primary documents and their testimony to the translation process utilized by the King James translators in detail. Listen, the stuff I've got planned to do is to take these resources and show you what they actually did and how they did it. At a ground level, and show you how this, see how this is a different handwriting than this? So there's first and second stage changes that are emblematic in this document. And you can compare first, second, and third stage changes to what ultimately ended up where? In the King James Bible. You can do all of this stuff if you just pay attention to the right documents. The problem, though, is that this takes a lot of time. And the other thing I just want to mention is I do have access to the 1602 Bishop's Bible text for the New Testament through the New Testament Octapla. The New Testament Octapla provides you in parallel columns with Tyndale, the Great Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, the Reams, the King James, the ASV, and the RSV. All right here, and this was put together this is totally out of print right now. I ordered this off Amazon, a discard. I think I paid like $90 for this thing, but it was totally worth it for the kind of stuff that we're doing here. Okay? So, folks, what all this means then is that a lot of the stuff that is said in King James-only books, literature, materials, not all of it, but quite a bit of it, is just wrong. It's just flat-out factually not true. So you have to be like Ronald Reagan here with these resources. Well, what do I mean by that? You have to verify, I'm going to say it this way, you have to verify, then trust. Reagan said, trust that, but verify. I'm saying verify before you what? Trust. Okay? All right. So we didn't make it to part two. So next Sunday we'll talk about the Elizabethan context, which is great because my lesson is pretty near done then already. Yeah?
Was this translation done pretty much in isolation, or was there any influence by King James during that?
King James set up the rules, and Archbishop Bancroft was basically the one who ran it. It's in late in the process, 1609, somewhere in there, there's evidence of James asking Bancroft where the thing stands, because they'd started in 1604. I mean, this thing took about 7 years to finish, to go through each step in the process. Okay? Any other questions?
You probably already covered this, but before Tyndale, what was the bishop's readings like, and how has that Tyndale's translation affected what the Catholic Church teaches based on?
I'm not following your.
They were using the Latin, weren't they? The Catholic
yes.
Thing?
Using the Latin, but how?
Yeah.
Right. How is Tyndale's, since Tyndale, how
is that affected? Well, here's a clue, Ken. Okay? So Tyndale's New Testament is 1526. The Bishop's Bible is 1568. The Great Bible is 1539. The Geneva, that's not on this list because it's out, it's kind of out here. It's still in the same stream, but it's not a direct predecessor. It'd be over here. It's 1560, right? Well, the Catholic Church at the Council of Trent in the mid-1500s at their Catholic Counter-Reformation meeting, they decide that the Latin Vulgate is like the infallible Word of God. So what happens to compete with all these English Bibles, what the Catholics do in 1586 is they produce the Reims New Testament in English, which is going to be a translation primarily of the Latin Vulgate. So the Catholics are going to feel the need to have a competitor to all these Protestant texts that are being translated in this whole stream of English Bible translating.
Are the Catholics encouraged to read the Bible on their own or not?
They weren't back then.
They weren't back then. It's really a matter of if they could siphon off some of these Protestant Bible readers to this Reims, then their marginal notes are pro-Catholic marginal notes. Is really their kind of like their one of their main strategies. Okay. Oh, we'll talk about the Reims for sure.
I've read that the Reims, that the King James translators also had the Reims. That was one of their.
Mike, you just always have to go there, don't you? This is another one of the things that is an absolute objective fact. Are there Reimish, from the Reims, are there Reimish readings in a King James Bible? Yes, there are some. That tells you, did they look at the Reims? But all of that is not supposed to be true because of the two streams. Remember when we looked at this before, I showed you that the Reims, does the Reims have a bunch of the verses in it that the modern versions leave out? Yes. So would you be better off reading the Reims than you would be an NIV? But nobody talks about that because of the way all this stuff was teed up by these King James advocates when the train left the station with a bunch of stuff in it that wasn't true. That's why you have to verify, then what?
Trust.
But we gotta quit, we gotta pack up and